The Football Show on Off the Ball
with Sky. Watch every UEFA Champions League and Europa League match live on BT Sport this season.
I'm prepared to do anything I can.
Well, do it then.
Country again.
Do it then.
What about your start to the game?
It wasn't bad, was it?
Why should an honest answer be a mistake?
How can a modern day manager not have a mobile phone?
Why should he?
Oh. Welcome along, Football Show. Lots to discuss. Daniel McDonald of the Irish Independent in studio. Hello, Dan.
Hello, Joe.
So, in no particular order, there is obviously the situation at Manchester United, which has been much discussed at this stage. There's also talk of a takeover at Dundalk. There's ticket touts. There's the promotioner in the FAI Cup final. Dan, I know you want to talk about that. There's Josh Cavallo in Australia. There is Finland 1, Republic of Ireland 2 from last night. There is also an extraordinary piece which has been written in The Athletic about the situation in Iceland when it comes to allegations of sexual assault against members of the team, and the Icelandic FA president has had to resign. All 15 board members have resigned, and Stuart James and Stefan Snare spent a week out in Iceland over the last while just talking to different people and trying to tie everything together. And one of the net results is that at their most recent qualifier, their national stadium, and we all think of Iceland and think of England at Euro 2016 and the thunderclap and the popularity. Just 1,600 people at their most recent game, their lowest crowd for a competitive fixture since 1997. So to say that the atmosphere around the team has become toxic is an understatement. So that's a story we'll touch on. Dan was tweeting about it earlier on this afternoon. Manchester United, it depends which paper you pick up. I saw the Sun over there saying United to give Solskjaer the Spurs match. Your paper reckons he has 3 games to save his job. So it's either Spurs match or 3 games, which brings him up to the international window. Either way, when we're talking about 1 to 3 games to save a job,
it doesn't look great when you get to that. I mean, I heard Andy Mitten on at you, I think, was it last night? And, you know, he's got time. That was Andy's information, wasn't it? He's got time, but he wasn't also saying he's got an indefinite amount of time. It was the more polite way of saying you've got X amount of games to save your job. I mean, this never ends well, does it? You know, when you get into this vulnerable situation, like, we always talked about this topic. I mean, in a way, you know, what do you talk about when he's gone? You know, like, the whole discourse around Manchester United is dominated by it. And I've always felt he was always a couple of games away from a crisis. And that's obviously, you know, you need to win your way out of that, like win a big trophy to get yourself out of that situation. But now it's just like, I don't know how you recover from it. And it's more the point even that the trashings are not like random events in games. Like, you can have bad luck, you can have a hammering. Like, even the Spurs one where they were hammered, was it 6-1 last year? There was a red card, and there are mad games where things happen, they run away from you. But it's more the sort of sustained issues, and, you know, Leicester and the first half against Atlanta and all of that feeding into what happened. I mean, Paul Scholes effectively predicted it, you know. And I don't know. I mean, where do you escape from that? You don't. So we'll see. You know, you tell me, as someone, you know, who might follow Manchester United affairs more closely, like, if they go and win at Spurs on Saturday, are people going to be lighting up sort of phone ins or text messages that even going, well, that shows like the players are with him, you know, he deserves another crack? Or is it irrelevant if then City just come and turn him over the following week? I don't see, like, you're living game to game until your next big defeat and then it'll be gone, right?
Probably, yeah. What manager wants to take over right now as well?
Well, I mean, well, there's probably thousands of work managers who, you know, who want to take over, you know, but I guess in that elite bracket, you know, of that super WhatsApp group of super managers, who is watching this LinkedIn premium, you know, LinkedIn premium managers, who's responding to this advertising?
When I say right now, I mean, I would just hang on until we get Spurs away.
Oh, sorry.
Man,
I take up
City,
your point.
I'll take over during the international window. That's the time to take over.
Oh, yeah. That's a classic boardroom tactic. If you want your new manager to come in, you do not want them to start off with a defeat. You want to look at the fixture list, look at your easiest run of 3 or 4 games, and then you end up with that great goodwill vibe of, well, look, you should have brought him in earlier.
When I say who wants to take over right now in the broader meaning of the word. I mean, lots. It's still a very attractive position.
Of course it is.
Very attractive.
It's still one of the top five jobs in the world.
And but also the football team are in good shape.
And it's a good squad. You know, you have to deal with the Ronaldo issue, obviously.
Deal with the Ronaldo issue. Get Conte in. Cristiano, you're
they do need someone like that, don't they?
They need someone to take on Ronaldo.
Listen, you know, the media were a nightmare when it comes to this stuff, really, the media, because you know that the thing that the manager needs to do is to probably come in and deal with the Ronaldo issue, you know, sensitively. Like, if the media glare didn't exist, you know, you could come in and sort of get on with it. But you just know that, like, and it's the right thing to ask because it's what we're talking about here. At your first press conference, Antonio Conte, are you prepared to drop Ronaldo? Should be a question that's asked, or a version of the same. And then from the start, that sets the agenda and you're, you know, you live or die by your actions arising from that. Now, some people would say, and it's not an unfair comment, that an elite coach, you know, can find a way to fit Ronaldo into his side and yet still be able to execute an effective game plan, you know, and that's what you're paying them for, you know. But evidently, like, it's you know, it's not a long term fix, Ronaldo, and it's pretty clear, you know, you'd need someone with a strength of personality that could manage the situation where Ronaldo just doesn't play some games.
That's some games, yeah. Challenge. Because Neville has made the point that in Ronaldo's first stint, Jason Park, Darren Fletcher, Tevez, Rooney did a lot of running for him. He was never a workhorse, Ronaldo. He was never up there, I'll press, I'll lead from the front. So there is a way to work around one passenger. Now, potentially, United's problem is they've Pogba and they've a few other. Bruno Fernandes, I think he's a showy presser as opposed to being an effective presser. I think
I'm running really hard here.
There's a little bit bit of show there as opposed to Jisung Park, who you'd realise had covered 15k a game without really noticing him. So, look, there are those extra issues around Ronaldo and Pogba and the balance of the squad and all that kind of stuff. But on the whole, there's a lot right with that squad.
No, there is. And sometimes, you know, you can always jump from one conclusion to the next. So it's like, and we've sort of done it there. You know, Ronaldo maybe, you know, need to drop him sometimes. The extreme of that becomes he just needs to not play at all. Like, there's going to be games where, you know, opposition team are defending deep and that's exactly who you want on the pitch, and he'll win them games and win them points and has done that this season. It's more at certain times. It's the accommodation of
them. Totally agree. We'll get bogged down in all this, and we talked a lot about United.
Yeah.
If Solskjaer was to draw with Spurs, beat Atalanta and lose to Man City 2-0, and they said, Ole, your time is up, thank you so much, you've done a very good job in many ways, what Premier League job would Solskjaer be offered?
It'd be hard to see him get anyone, wouldn't it, really? I mean, like, see, again, with these things, like, you see certain managers getting, this is a very tactical answer, but, like, you know, you have some managers who are in jobs because they're very well connected to, like, super agents or something like that. So they'll get into a job very soon, whether they should or not. But I don't get the sense that he has that connection. He came in through a slightly different route. You know, it's not like, you know, there was some powerful broker, you know, a sort of Zahavi figure or something who got him in. Like, you know, you saw, like, Mark Hughes, for example, got into Man City. He was pretty very, very well connected with his agent. Then, he popped up in a lot of places afterwards. Did I see someone say the other day, was it Jan Agerfjordtoft? I don't actually want to get that wrong, but someone in the Norwegian sphere of things who thought he'd be going to their national team eventually. So, which is a logical one, but I couldn't really see the Premier League angle. You know, do you? You know, I couldn't see it.
No, I don't think so.
No, he did all right. I mean, I know people can be disparaging about it, but, like, he did quite a good job at Molde at a very different level, and clearly is probably in some ways a project type of manager. And in reality, if you go below the top five or six clubs in the Premier League, your job is generally more quick hit. Anyway, there's very few. You have someone like, you might have Graham Potter there, who's a bit more of a, you know, it was a concept, like the appointment of going for someone like that, and even maybe Hasenhüttl to a degree, you know, but a lot of the other appointments are more in and out. You know, maybe some of the ones coming up actually are maybe fit into that mold, but, like, I don't see him. He's not going to become, like, one of those managers who you're thinking, there's 12 games to go in the season, we're struggling here, go and get Solskjaer. Like, that's not his gig, you know.
Do you think he has done a very good job in lots of ways and handled lots of situations like Pogba last year, where Mino Raiola came out and said that he was going to leave at the end of the season. That was on the eve of a Champions League game. Handled a lot of those situations well, whereas with Mourinho, they turned into raging fires and were
awful. Oh, yeah.
Maybe the big mistake he made was not getting a more experienced coaching staff when you think about it. As in, you've Carrick there and you have Kieran McKenna.
Fermanagh, yeah.
Fletcher. Yeah. And then you've Mike Phelan, who looks very much on the outside of things now. Sort of Mike Phelan is, he never seems to be too involved in any conversations, although he does have experience. But I get the impression he's slightly outside of the inner circle. It's hard to know. But you think of Ferguson, who had the humility, and it was a humility, to recognise post-winning the treble that the game was changing, that 4-4-2 wasn't going to work anymore. Who can take me forward? And it was Carlos Queiroz.
Yeah.
And that resulted, admittedly, in going off and buying Evran and things not quite running smoothly all the time. But there was an evolution there.
Yeah.
So that was Ferguson saying, well, I don't know everything. I look at Solskjaer's team, the touch and experience. They looked a little caught in the headlights on Sunday.
Yeah, no, I do see that point. I mean, I think it is one of those things that is said when things are going badly, because clearly you have to find a reason and you have to find something.
I wasn't saying it 2 months ago.
No, and you know, could you tell me who the backroom teams were of, you know, a load of other, like,
go on, hit me.
Well, I don't know. Come on, give me. Well, give me your Liverpool backup. You should actually know the Liverpool one.
I do. I can't pronounce his name.
Pep.
Linders.
Yeah, like so.
However, the simple answer there is irrelevant. Jurgen Klopp. Yeah. The simple answer with Mourinho is irrelevant, Mourinho.
Yeah, no, it's true. Like, Thomas Tuchel came in to Chelsea.
I don't need to know Tuchel's either.
But for example, well, some people might have said he needs someone who knows the Premier League. That might, if things had gone badly, they might have said, well, maybe he should have called on.
Fair enough.
Like, for example, he retained Anthony Barry, who's getting rave reviews for his work with Ireland. But Anthony Barry's 34, you know, and had previously been at Wigan,
yeah.
You know what I mean, and hadn't had a great career as a player. Like, people talk sometimes about you should have this experienced figure with you, and maybe people can scream like loads of brilliant examples to me. Maybe there are, like, you know, back in the day, Southgate have Terry Venables in helping him out for a while. But sometimes in those arrangements, it almost serves to drum home the manager's inexperience that they've had to go for this figure, you know, to guide them.
I
know
that,
you have great coaches.
Venables,
Steve Holland would have been under Mourinho, who had a great reputation as a top coach, and McLaren came from that sort of school, to be fair. You know, his profile came after that time. Like, he was regarded as a great number two. I'm not disagreeing with you. It's just, I think it's more a case of people are, I understand where this is coming from now, and if it's true that players are maybe uninspired by some of this, then that's a problem. But I don't know, for someone in Ole's position, you know, is it not better for him to, for someone who has question marks around his authority, that he is seen as the most authoritative coach in that group, as opposed to, like, bringing in someone who's towers over him?
I'm not saying towers over him, and I'm not saying high profile. Like, geez, bring in Venables.
Bit more, no, I know what you're saying. That's an extreme version of it. It would have been good fun, obviously, if he'd done a modern version of it.
Yeah.
He brings in Tony Pulis for defensive work.
I'm talking about scouring European football for the best thought of coaches and saying, I'm at Manchester United, let's come, let's talk. Whereas Carrick, Fletcher.
McKenna was one of those. I did a piece of McKenna who was at Spurs previously and you know, now has been spoken about in negative terms, but prior to that was being spoken about as an up and coming.
Well, up and coming is the issue. Up and coming,
like Anthony Barry, you know.
Yeah, and Anthony Barry. But when the manager is inexperienced, I just think it's a question mark.
Yeah, no, I think, listen, I think the most significant aspect of that, and of course, I did see Gary Neville pointing this out, that, you know, when things are going badly, stuff comes out that it may be players and people have to sort of, you know, people around players are, well, all of a sudden it's like, well, the coaching staff is the problem. The players are the problem.
No, the PR game at the moment is awful.
Becomes an issue, but it's something that's said a lot. You know, a certain manager is in a situation and they say, well, they should have got someone experienced around them, but I just think that's a difficult thing to do. Like, even
it's too late now.
To establish that trust even as well. Like, maybe he wants a team around him that he really trusts. Fair. And that's a very important thing. That's and fair. Some people, you see examples where people have had a coach foisted upon them, and that actually can be seen as undermining your authority in some way. So does he have someone in his previous life, you know, and places he's worked with that he could have leaned upon? Maybe. And maybe there's something in that. Maybe there is a valid point with it.
Is there a takeover imminent at Dundalk?
There is, I think so, yeah. No, I mean, there is. Although, like, people who have obviously, you know, Dundalk have been a very high-profile club over the last 7-8 years in the sort of above average, so for like a League of Ireland side, and that, you know, people who maybe just tune in and out and drop in and out will have seen them winning a lot of stuff, will have seen them in the Europa League group stages twice, and may wonder why they're now battling to avoid, you know, relegation this season. And there's been a lot of headlines generated by off the field stuff there, and you would have covered it previously on this show, and Shane Keegan would have spoken recently about maybe idiosyncratic aspects of his working life there. While everything comes with the caveat that people making decisions there are prone to change their mind at very short notice, and change their focus, it does appear, yeah, there's been very advanced discussions about selling up, to the point where, you know, people have submitted written offers and they're awaiting correspondence on those offers. So it does appear there will be a departure of the American ownership and new ones will be coming in.
And am I right to believe it's the Saudis?
Not the Saudis, no, not the Saudis. There may possibly be an Iranian link, all right, to the prospective new owners, okay, who, my understanding, are sort of in pole position at the moment, which would be, and I would have written about this evening, there's a sort of an Iranian businessman, Welsh Iranian businessman, who runs Glentoran as part of a consortium. And my information would be that a sort of consortium linked to the Glentoran ownership are now very much to the fore, right, in the Dundalk bid, versus the alternative, which would be a more local consortium made up of some of the previous owners prior to the Americans, and also Stat Sports, the sort of they're a tech firm who people may be aware of for their work with sports science, like, around the world. You know, they're a real success story, and they're the two, I think, main bids in the shake up, and it may be leaning north at the moment as opposed to local.
Okay, so the situation at the moment is that the club is very much up for sale, and it's bring your bids to us, as opposed to, well, we've just suddenly been landed with an offer we couldn't refuse unexpectedly.
Yeah, okay. Yeah.
They want out.
They do. Yeah. And
Peak six,
yeah. I mean, I don't want to sort of bog down with detail that can make it too dense, but yeah, it is basically peak six. Yes, they are not, they don't own 100% of the club, but they're the principal owners.
And how long have they been looking to get out for?
Well, that's an interesting point in itself, because I sort of now would be aware that there's been, across the year, I think there's been discussions and, you know, advances and talks going on. But it's only really, and which would make you think that maybe they were looking to get out from a while back, but it's only really since the summer you've got the sense that they're ready to go. Like, just maybe to put some points in the road on this, like, Dundalk last year in 2020 qualified for the Europa League group stages, which was a huge achievement. It was after they got a bit of a quirky route through, and it was with Filippo, the Italian manager, who was plucked out of nowhere. And I remember the night that they beat Sheriff, who are now, like, Sheriff are sort of an incredible story.
Yeah.
And they beat Sheriff in a penalty shootout, and basically they ended up playing a team from the Faroes, and there's like $3 million for getting into the group stages. And I remember talking to some people around that time who were thinking that peak six, the Americans, they'd come in, they had plans for breaking Europe, they'd made some quirky decisions, they were on course to lose a fair bit of money last year, and then all of a sudden they qualify for the group stages. And that was a real point in the road where some people thought, in golf parlance, you know, we could be level par here. You know, this is a chance for maybe things aren't necessarily going great, and maybe this could be the point where they talk about maybe finding a way out, but no damage done. What they decided to do over the winter was instead go again and invest quite heavily in the squad, in particular on a load of players from overseas. And it's been an absolute disaster. An absolute disaster. They've got a lot of hassle, a lot of grief. I think it's you know, Peak Six are trying to invest in football clubs elsewhere, and I think even, you know, the internet exists, you know, your digital footprint exists, and I think some of the mistakes they've made at Dundalk have probably not been great for their brand, and I think it's been clear for some time that they would be open two offers, and I think that's obviously come to a head now.
And so you mentioned that a consortium involved with Glentoran or maybe
linked to the ownership. I don't want to. It's a bit grey to some degree, but certainly there is a link with that group.
So how would you describe them then?
Well, they are. I think they are a Northern Irish consortium. Not everyone is from Northern Ireland, and they're linked with the group who currently run Glentoran. I'm not saying it's 100% all of the same people run Glentoran or 100% all of the same people, because I can't stand over that.
Okay.
But there's certainly there's a link there. Mags Byrne, who previously chief executive of Sunderland, is not part of that consortium, but I believe has been a part of, she has a good relationship with the Americans and has maybe been a bit of a go-between in terms of getting people talking to each other.
And would you say, for Dundalk fans listening, so they may be of interest, will be of interest, is this a big injection of money? Is this a fairly even-handed type consortium that's taken over?
It's unclear. Okay. I think it's unclear. I think... because they're a bit of an unknown quantity, and I think they would have to prove themselves to people if they come in. And I think, having previously seen the club leave local hands to the outside investment from America, and that hasn't gone well, I think there would be a slight wariness about handing it over to another group who haven't fully revealed themselves, shall we say. I presume they will in due course, but at the moment they haven't. Whereas the alternative is a more local company, local people that they know. I think that would probably be the preferred one for a lot of people from Dundalk. So I think if this other crew did happen to get it, I think they'd have a fair bit of work to do to convince people, because people have been burned by
the foreign experience.
The unknown.
Understand. Okay. Yeah. By the way, Vinnie Perth was just talking, so they lost to St. Pat's obviously on Monday, and relegation. Hangs over the club, the potential of it. And just to make a bad situation worse, two backroom staff, medical physio staff, Danny Miller and Graham Norton, left. And, you know, Vinnie Perth was talking about how this has hurt the players and they're going to be a big loss. And clearly it's not a good thing when you've trusted medical and physio staff who've been there for the good days and have the trust of the players depart, not least at this point in the season when things are so grim. So it's everything coming out seems
like
a mess.
I mean, it, sometimes we get accused of sort of exaggerating stuff, you know, in the media, that's the thing. But really, like, there's no other way of phrasing it but that, like, it's been one disaster after the other there, you know. And the stream of departures from the club over the last 12 to 18 months, be it playing, be it medical, be it administrative or
staff retention,
volunteer, like, and even within that piece you referenced of Vinnie Perth, I think he was speaking after the game on Monday, and he also spoke on radio about it. We have a situation where the manager is basically saying, so these backroom members have left under a bit of a cloud, and the manager is saying, I can completely understand why they did it. It, you know, and making references to the environment behind the scenes, then it's not good. It's like there's a clear clash of personalities with people there. And I'm not saying it's linked, by the way, to those backroom departures, but I think generally I would have spoken about this, you know, written about this previously. You had a situation where even Vinnie Perth came back in the summer. The sporting director, Jim McGilton, and people would be obviously very familiar with his name, ex-Northern Ireland international, it would be widely known that he was opposed to Vinnie Perth coming back, yet the decision was made to bring Vinnie Perth back. It's not conducive to like a very good working relationship.
Some friction points there.
And there's been loads of that stuff, versions of that stuff going on. And what they need is certainty and clarity. What I would say, just to finish on this, like, they play Waterford on Friday in what is a really important game, because Waterford are currently arguably their main or one of their main rivals to avoid that relegation playoff. I don't think the atmosphere is going to be great up there on Friday, because there's a lot of anger, a lot of local anger up there, and it'll be interesting to see how that plays itself out.
Okay, you're listening to Dan McDonald there of the Irish Independent. Dan's staying with us. Loads more to talk about. Football on Off the Ball is brought to you by Sky, all the football you love in one place across Sky Sports, BT Sport and Premier Sports. We're back in one sec.
Who knows more about Munster rugby, me or you, Quinny?
Everyone has an opinion, don't they? Some of the opinions are waffle, but I'd like to think I know a lot.
The Red 78 with Alan Quinlan and Niamh Briggs. Subscribe to the Rugby Channel on the OTB Sports app and turn on your notifications now.
Welcome back. Joe Malloy, Dan McDonald here. So just about to go full times in the League Cup games this evening. Liverpool 2-0 up away to Preston, Minamino and Origi with the goals there. We have Brentford 2-1 up away to Stoke. Still nil all. West Ham at home to Man City this evening in the Premier League affair. Burnley 0, Tottenham 1, and it's 2-2 between Leicester and Brighton. Another Premier League affair there. So that is where we are in the League Cup this evening. Dan, the Portugal match is sold out.
Yeah.
55,000. Very happy customers, or so we thought. So
only 52, I believe, Joe. That's the issue.
Only 52.
It says 51,700, but I think that even with seat kills and stuff, there might be a bit less than that. Yeah.
Okay.
That's why. I mean, maybe if it was 55,000, we wouldn't have this issue.
I suspect we may. So people were really keen to get the tickets for a whole host of reasons. Ronaldo in town definitely helps things along, and then of course we're all starved to go to see Ireland, so that helps too. And Portugal are a glamour side. So within minutes, I think, of going on general sale, people were disappointedly realising that there were no tickets left. And then pretty quickly on resale websites, there were tickets for the match being quoted at €420, for instance.
Yeah.
More than three times their face value. And so this was an area of concern, as you can imagine. So it's kind of an interesting one. I'm going to play two clips. Noel Rock is a former Fine Gael TD. He was with Henry McKean this morning, and he was involved in drafting the now current legislation when it comes to ticket touting. And he was just explaining why, in spite of the legislation, it didn't have an effect on the Portugal game. So have a listen.
Well, as a fan, it's massively disappointing. The reason I wrote the legislation and campaigned for the legislation to be enacted was to ensure that this didn't happen, to ensure that fans were protected. The legislation, as I wrote it, was amended and changed, which meant that venues had to be designated, or events had to be designated and opt in to this legislation in effect. In the case of this event, or this venue, the Aviva Stadium, that didn't happen. The FAI took their eye off the ball, in essence. However, there is obviously a legitimate criticism to be had that maybe they shouldn't have needed to opt in the first place. But when it comes to this particular event, it's quite clear that the FAI were aware that they could have opted in, but didn't opt in time. What I would hope will happen now is that the FAI will choose to designate the Aviva Stadium, along with the IRFU, as a designated venue, and accordingly, all future games will be protected and fans will be protected. That was always the intent of the legislation. That's what I hope will happen from here.
So that was Noel Rock. Here's Leo Varadkar.
This is new legislation. It's only just been enacted in the last couple of months. So under the legislation, the initial onus is on the organiser or the host of the event to designate it. So I understand that the FAI has now put in an application to have the Ireland-Portugal match designated, and my department is working on that application now. But what we're going to do today and tomorrow and over the next couple of days is sit down with Croke Park, sit down with the Aviva, sit down with the major sporting bodies, FAI, GAA and IRFU, and suggest to them, or at least impress on them, the advantages of having those events designated, because we have three rugby internationals coming up, as you know. There'll be other soccer internationals as well, and we want to make sure that as many of them get designated as possible. Like I say, FAI have put that application in now. Perhaps they should have done it sooner, perhaps we should have acted sooner, but like I say, this is new legislation, and those meetings are going to happen over the next couple of days.
I mean,
hit me with some words, Joe.
Idiotic.
What? The fact it wasn't covered.
I mean, come on.
Yeah.
Like, our politicians. We'll get on, I mean, the administrators, FAI.
Don't start me on politicians and spoil it.
Oh,
I
tell you
Joe.
The problem with politicians.
How's that World Cup bit going? Anyway, sorry.
Imagine we were sitting around saying, Dan, Taoiseach's been on to us. Me and you have to draft up some kind of legislation against ticket touting. What venues would you say, Dan, ticket touting might be most likely to be an issue for us going forward? What would you say? Give me one. Give me two.
Yeah. Well, I mean, it's very hard. I've seen a couple of touts outside Daily Mail in the last couple of years, to be fair.
No, Daily Mail's popular.
Demand's been an issue.
Dan, there's no bad ideas.
Because it was 3,000 people only allowed to go, but still.
I'm going to keep Daily Mail on the table. But give me, what would you say? Give me two that might jump to mind. Yeah, you know, events that might have ticket touts.
Well, where are we holding the 2030 World Cup? It's in the Aviva in Croke Park, isn't it? I think that's where we're having it.
To not just say, well, if we're talking about touting, we're talking about these two venues in 90% of cases. Let's just stick automatically have these inbuilt into our legislation.
Yeah.
Like, it's that. is pretty embarrassing stuff. Do you know what makes you wonder? With actually more complicated stuff, can you imagine the stuff that's going on in Leinster House? Can you imagine the cock-ups that we don't even hear about half the time?
Well, I don't think you need to imagine it. We can just see how things play out.
Do we still use that printer? Remember they had to change the printer because it was too high for the roof and they had to spend a gazillion to fix the printer.
That's just added to the list. As I said,
was a good one.
The thick of it, reality. I'm trying to figure out which is which.
In fairness to Noel Rock, he did say, oh, well, look, maybe we should have thought about...
Yeah,
and so hands up. But I mean,
proactive on that sort of policy for some period of time. To be fair to him, but it does appear like, and I mean, there would be a view that maybe that still the FEI maybe might have dropped the ball to some degree as well by not applying for this.
So there's the politicians and then the administrators. So we're sitting around. Should we discuss touting once? You know, there's new touting legislation. Should we talk about that for 5 minutes? Apparently, we have to apply for it to. Cover our fan base.
Yeah, I think that's a fair point. I think there's
between the two of them. Yeah, creating an issue that where both messed up so badly.
Yeah, no, it is. I mean, I think it's more. It seems to me like I've only actually heard those clips. I wasn't necessarily working on this today because I know Leo Vrecker did it at a news event. It would have come up with other stuff, so it wasn't, say, a sports press conference event where I heard all the questions and all the discussions around it. But it does appear like, you know, there was like straightforward ways to avoid this, you know, that could have been
I just heard the clips as well,
exactly, and that'd be my like, that's the, I think most people who hear that would probably reach that conclusion, to be fair, you know. But sometimes you're missing some reasons that it was a bit more complicated, you know, in some way. It just seems like in Irish life at the moment we spend our whole time talking about, well, the legislation's coming in Thursday, now it's Friday, now it's Sunday, a couple of days, actually we'll get it done by midnight. It's like a constant to-do list that people don't realise, you know, we can maybe get some of this sorted earlier. Because that was the thing, it took a couple of days, then it's midnight tonight, this legislation is now coming in. So, I mean, you can get these things done sometimes with a bit of urgency. Yeah. Maybe everyone's just like, it's like a serious theme and everyone's so buzzing that like an Ireland game was sold out initially. It's like, what was it? Maybe the FAI weren't prepared for an Ireland game to sell out. I mean, they've spent the guts of the last decade trying to give people tickets to go to the games.
All they probably had to do was send an email then.
I know.
The touting stuff. We'll go for that.
If there's a touts WhatsApp group of some description or some message board where they all go, I think in recent years, I don't think they've been thinking, well, let's get ourselves down to the Aviva. Ireland are playing. It's more a case of, well, there's no point of us going down there because the FAI are actively giving tickets to like hordes of school children to like fill games and fill stadiums.
No, I get all that. I want you to dig into this deeper for me.
Okay.
I want you to find out, what would the FAI have had to do to be covered? Like, is there a form they would have to fill out? Or like, is there a text message they'd respond to?
Yeah,
I just want to know exactly what they didn't do.
Everyone has to fill out forms now, you know, for COVID. Like, you know, you have to go to some event. It's like, just tick, you know, 4 or 5 boxes. Yeah. Maybe it was one of those.
I want to know what they didn't do that they could have just done.
I think asking appears to be the...
I'm just thinking on the phone.
It's like, any chance, you know?
Joe and Dan, we hear you're drafting the legislation. Put us down for one.
Like, it's like a docket, you know?
Let's move off.
You need a docket to book a taxi. You just need to submit the docket.
It's too ridiculous. This one's too ridiculous.
Yeah.
Anyway. So, Josh Cavallo, we wanted to touch on.
Yeah.
21 years of age. If you haven't heard of Josh Cavallo, that's okay. He's only really... Well, I've gone global, I suppose, today in many ways. He plays in the A-League in Australia. He plays for Adelaide United, like I said, 21 years of age. He is now the only known current male top flight professional footballer in the world.
Mm.
Seems to come out as gay. He released a video. It's been a journey to get to this point in my life. Couldn't be happier with my decision to come out. I've been fighting my sexuality for over 6 years now. I'm glad I can put that to rest. He talked about how he always felt the need to hide himself because I was ashamed I'd never be able to do what I loved and be gay. Hiding who I truly am to pursue a dream I always wished for as a kid, to play football and to be treated equally, never felt like a reality. And then he said, and I thought this was quite an interesting point, he's talking about the process of hiding. He said, I had no emotions. My life was great, but it wasn't a life where I got to be my authentic self. Instead of celebrating, I sat in my bed crying at night. Having to constantly lie to the people I cared about wasn't the way I wanted to live the rest of my life. My double life started to have a huge influence on my mental health. And I'm sure it did. So the reaction generally from the footballing world, everybody from Gary Lineker to Gerard Piqué to Antoine Griezmann on social media has been massively supportive. And that's where we are at the moment. So
yeah, I think a point where people, this story comes up, people will say, well, this shouldn't be a news story. And of course, that's fundamentally correct in that, you know, you would hope that this wasn't a news story. But the reason it is a news story is because players sort of within men's football who feel comfortable enough to come out and say that are in such a minority. You know, they're just not in a position where they feel free to do it. You know, there's a handful of examples in recent years. I think Thomas Hitzlberger, there was the American guy Robbie Rogers.
Yeah. Now Hitzlberger, you know, he came out after he'd retired in 2013.
Yeah.
And Robbie Rogers was retiring and had retired, but then he returned to the LA Galaxy after the announcement and won the MLS Cup. So he became, in effect, the first openly gay male athlete to win a major professional team sport title in the United States.
Yeah. Yeah. And like people are aware, I guess, of the story of Justin Fashanu going back in time in English football. And I think why this is a talking point is because of the facts we lay out there, that so few people feel willing to do it. And it's a case of why is it in football it's harder than maybe in some other sports, although again, you know, I think across sport generally it's an issue. But clearly there's more to do to get to this situation where the discussion of this is no longer relevant, you know, that it's just a matter of fact thing. Mm. But I do think I don't have any issue with it being a big story. I think it's important that it is. I think it's extremely important that it is, even though there will probably be extremes of reaction he might be exposed to that might in some cases make other people more reluctant to do it. You mentioned the high profile support that he's got. Like, unfortunately, you do need these people to lead the way to the point where for the next generation it's not a bigger thing. But I think if we talked about this maybe in 2013, with that Robbie Rogers case, which I remember discussing at the time, we probably would have hoped by 2021 we'd be further along down that road than we are, and we're not.
Mm. Yeah. I mean, it is very depressing that we're still.
Oh yeah, you want not to have to talk about it.
No.
Like, you know what I mean? And
I do remember.
But you still have to. It has to be. It's a chat that needs to be to be sort of, I hate to use the word, but to be normalised. You know, that it's no longer a thing. It just comes up.
Yeah.
Again.
Yeah.
We're a long way from that in football. A long, long way from it.
Do you think so?
Yeah. Of course I do. Yeah. I mean.
I wouldn't be as sure, actually.
Well, I mean, you know, it'd be a great thing to be wrong on, but I think you're still talking. When you're talking about football, I still, you know, globally, you know, it's the biggest sport, and you think of all, it's played in all sorts of different cultures and societies, and you know, some very liberal, some not, and yet, you know, you're still looking at a very sort of small statistical number. And again, like, you can talk about, not to bring Everton back to Newcastle, but you know, you look at instances, you know, where ownerships of certain clubs are coming from and stuff, and do players want to even invite that discussion for themselves? You know, I mean,
that's a fair point. Yeah. Mm. I mean, I guess the hope would be very soon, high profile player comes forward. Again, this, you see, I hate talking about even the phrase coming out.
I know, like, I hate it as well. And the language of it is so, you know, you can end up coming across in a way you don't want to come across, you know, by speaking about it. Like, it's.
So hopefully, high profile player decides, screw this, I'm pretty open about this, no big deal to me, I'm an open person, I, you know, it's not some big weight I'm carrying to just say it, and says it. And I'd be pretty optimistic that generally we'd realise very quickly that people get on with it, that the abuse isn't intolerable, that generally it's a massively supportive environment, and then within 5 years after that there's multitudes.
Yeah, no, that is the ideal scenario. But yeah, again, in 2021, we've seen issues in the last 12 months with, you know, around racism in stadiums. We've seen a situation in Hungary. We've seen, you know, the situation in Hungary where there was obviously legislation there which was sort of related to maybe the LGBT community there feeling less welcome in their own country. I think their goalkeeper spoke out about it and got some grief around it, didn't he? You know, so again, like, the climate, there isn't a broad climate, I think, within football that would make people, I think, feel it's entirely welcoming that that could happen in great numbers. I would love to be wrong about that, of course, but I'm not sure if I 100% share your confidence, but maybe in a generation's time we're talking about that rather than maybe 5 years' time.
And do you think it's more fear of the terraces or fear of the dressing room?
Yeah, I wonder about that. I'm not so sure the dressing room thing would be as big a thing. I don't know, but I would imagine that there are cases where dressing rooms are aware of a of a player's sexuality, but just, you know, it's not in the public domain. I think to some degree, because there's such a handful of examples, you instantly become high profile the minute you say that's where you are, you know. And what you want is that strength in numbers to the point where you cease to, like, we're talking about a player playing for Adelaide that we would never talk about for any other reason, you know. And that's why he's making headlines around the world. As I said, I understand why that is, but you know, you need to reach the point where it's not even something we need to talk about.
Yeah, exactly. Finland 1, Republic of Ireland 2. That's a massive result for...
it's huge.
So
yeah,
that sets them up. If they don't get second place now, something will have gone badly wrong.
Yeah, I think so. I think it was a Karen Duggan on this morning with the lads. Like, you know, it does feel sometimes they've had the problem with being the clinical team as the favourites almost, you know. And it's probably a thing we've seen with the men's team, with Irish football teams, not always great in that scenario. But I think that feels like a real landmark victory for them. It's put themselves in this position that really, if they're efficient against Slovakia and certainly Georgia, I think everyone's expected to hammer them, but it seems like the Slovakia games are pretty key. If they can be efficient against them, then yeah, it comes round to Finland coming to Dublin later next year, I believe it is, and really you just need to avoid defeat in that game, and you're fine. And who knows, if Finland like do something to Sweden, you know, you can dream bigger. Probably unlikely, you would think, but they've put themselves in a great position. I think even after the failure of the Euros, where really they messed it up, you know, they completely, it was a bottle job, really.
They were in
pole
it's
a horrible
position.
Thing to say, but it's a complete bottle job. I think even to get to a playoff, even if they don't get through it, I still think to get to a match of that size with the interest that's building now, I think it would be massive. And I think the playoff system for the runners-up, there's a degree of complication around it, but effectively if they're runners-up, like they're going to have the biggest game that Irish women's football has ever experienced, you know, in this country. And that is a great thing. It's not some kind of manufactured interest, you know, it's real. This is proper big games coming. So yeah, it's great to put themselves in that position, but now they've set a standard for themselves that, of course, they have to follow up on.
Before a clock comes against us, I mentioned at the top of the show a piece that you were tweeting about earlier in The Athletic that you obviously recommend and people should check it themselves. It's Stuart James and Stephen Snare in The Athletic. "The Viking clap is ruined forever" is the headline. We all remember the Viking clap. Iceland, everybody's second favourite team at the Euros. They beat England very famously. Smallest nation to ever qualify for World Cup finals, and the thunderclap. And you would have thought, well, you know, God, this is just a great story all over. Flash forward a couple of years, their most recent World Cup qualifier against Armenia in the national stadium, empty seats everywhere. The crowd is 1,697, their lowest crowd for a competitive fixture since 1997. And the point being made and the point teased out across this very long piece is that Icelandic football and this senior men's team in particular has been hit with accusations of sexual assault. And the board members, all 15 board members and the president resigned during the summer. Now, when I say this team, I mean some individuals on this team, not this entire team. That's an important distinction to make. But the Icelandic FA are in crisis, plunged into crisis, resignations everywhere. claims of, well, there were no complaints made, and then it turns out alleged victims are coming forward saying, well, I did make a complaint, for instance, and that was the reason the president had to resign over the summer. So it's a long piece, it's a dense piece, it's complicated, but it's a shocking state of affairs.
It is, yeah. No, I definitely think, you know, with something like that, it's a lengthy piece. I don't know how long it is, but, you know, thousands of words. And as I said, it's like you work on pieces of that nature, you know, it's very important. You have to have all the nuances of, you know, the claims, the counterclaims, the defence, and, you know, there's a lot to it. And that's why you don't want to sort of just, I don't know, rashly sort of read out certain lines from it. It's one of those where you need to go through the whole thing. But certainly what you can say is that sort of stark bottom line image of the Icelandic national team that were the heroes of Euro 2016 wasn't even just like the crowd scenes and the victories. It was that even we would have been on here probably talking afterwards about the Icelandic Federation. They give their money, their prize money to the clubs. Aren't they a great example to associations everywhere for how to, you know, maximise this and that? And yet this piece paints a very different picture of the climate around that team and of the stewardship and the leadership of football in that country. And as you said, the facts are the facts. You know, people have resigned their position, the board has been forced to leave, you know, the top man had to step away, and clearly the public have spoken. When you have a situation where 1700 people are attending an Iceland game within what, 5 years of that, it would suggest that people on the ground there are taking this matter seriously. They're not just dismissing it as paper talk or whatever. This is something that's led to a real crisis of confidence there, and it's yeah, it's quite shocking stuff. Right, I mean, the one thing I would say is the detail that really struck with me was the suggestion, the inference, that before the squad for a recent international was picked, they actually had to bring in some campaigners of a group to see that they were okay with all the names on the list.
Okay.
Which is mad stuff. And as I said, you know, that's not to be sort of sweeping a brush over the whole thing, but just even the fact that that's a discussion that's happening, it's very unusual.
Okay. Yeah. Dan McDonald of the Irish Independent. Cheers, Dan. Thanks for that this evening.
Thanks
a million.